name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to say something to our leader tonight. He said he heard me when he was 6 months sober. He don't remember a thing. I'll try to speak very simply tonight. I'm having a little bit of a culture shock. Last week I was talking in a couple of groups in New Zealand, where it's wintertime. And in Invercargill in the southern tip, it's snowing and icy. It's the last southernmost city in the world. You're down near the Antarctic somewhere. And I remember standing there, and the room was not adequately filled. I mean, it was filled, but it wasn't adequately warmed. And I said, God, it'd be good to get back where it's warm. After that, I was sitting there thinking, I wonder how I can get back to Invercargill. And to make it worse, tomorrow night I got to speak at a dinner in Yuma. I have no sense of Fresno, but I got a good sense of Yuma. I've been waiting to use that joke for 5 years. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I want to thank our chairman tonight, Javier, and Chad, with 1 week, and Jerry, who came to the airport and greeted me and picked me up. And I must say that Chad and Javier are pretty slick. I just had a suit bag that I was carrying in case I wanted to change shirts after I drowned in the last one. They gave it to Jerry, and I couldn't imagine why. I finally discovered obviously his sight is impaired, and he thought everybody else had a bag too, and he just... pretty slick. But Javier carried, Jerry carried my bag, so you can sit in my chair, Jerry, and maybe the serenity and wonderfulness will wear off. But I'm glad to be here, Dan. I used to come up to Fresno a lot years ago. Started coming up here 35 years ago, I guess, first time I came up. And I came here for a lot of them. Recently, I've been asked a few times the last couple of years, but I never could find a date, or we couldn't settle on a date. But I'm glad to be here next. I like Fresno, and it's good to be here, and it's glad to see your airport has finally emerged into the 20th century. But we are not here to discuss that. We are here to discuss what we are here for. Oh, I was talking to this gentleman when all of you joined in and said, principles before personalities. I leaned over and said, why do you say that? And he had a reason, which sounded pretty spiritual, but I want to tell you where that came from, and then you'll know. I mean, I hate to waste time doing this, but Bill Wilson wants me to do this from heaven. About 33, 34 years ago in the San Fernando Valley, a guy named Bill W., not Bill Wilson, but Bill W., he was an old kind of a cranky old guy and kind of an intense guy. And he had strong feelings about things, and one of the feelings was that no one in AA should be ever prominent, shouldn't even be widely known. Just, you know, you wouldn't even tell anybody else, and see the next year your last name. Yeah. Call me, I'm in the book, my name is Fred, you know. What he would do, this old guy, when they read the 12 traditions, he would whisper along and do that part. He'd say, principles before personalities. They'd say, oh, for God's sake, Bill, shut up. I'm not going to shut up. Needs to be said. And then three or four young guys, one of whom I knew and sponsored, they got to mocking Bill. So he'd say, principles before personalities. They'd say, principles before personalities. Is that right, Bill? Say, shut up. I'm not going to shut up. You know. And this went on for a while. Then after... some guy from the Canoga Park meeting was speaking there one night and heard this going on and thought of some spiritual breakthrough and took it back to the Canoga Park meeting. And for about 15 years, there were four groups in the middle of the San Fernando Valley where they all said, principles before personalities. People got there to speak. I was going to have to speak for the chanters tonight, for the Greek chorus, you know. And that was all right, too, except somehow the cork got out of the bottle and the germs got in the wind somehow and they blew around and out. You go to different places, you find people say, principles before personalities. Tonight is at the end of chapter 5 for no reason whatsoever. God told the world saw. They'd probably say it at the end of the promises, too, if they knew what they were. we in AA do not judge. So I'm not judgmental. But it is, if you are new tonight, Chad, you're back new again. It's nice to have one lower companion anyway you can count on. Anyway. But those of you who are new tonight and haven't formed any habits yet, I probably can't do anything when people have been here a long time, 5 or 6 months. They're probably set in their ways. They don't know. But the people who are new, you don't have to join in. In fact, the group where that started, the secretary now gets up and asks him not to chant. They've been doing that for years because it has no purpose. It just distracts the new people. It has nothing to do with anything. And if you're new tonight, I'm not saying you shouldn't join in and chant, but you don't have to. It's nothing to do with AA. And it's done, not done. My own group, 1,100 people every Wednesday night, and nobody says it there. I mean, they're welcome to. But nobody does it. Most groups, they don't. But they do it in some groups. And all I'm saying is you don't have to do it. And if you do it, you're doing nothing spiritual or nothing for AA. You're just mocking Bill W. Now, who else can I offend next? I come from a little town up in northern Wisconsin, and when I was a boy, I was kind of restless and irritable and discontent when the war started, and I was having some trouble because I came from a very strong religious family in Norwegian Lutheran Church. They're not very big on the West Coast or anywhere else, really. They're big in Wisconsin. I'll tell you, all people say, what are Norwegians like? I'll tell you all you need to know about Norwegians. I was speaking at Oslo last September, and I got thinking about this, because I came from a family. All these Norwegians that I know, but our family, left Norway in 1870, 1880, 1890, came to America to get away from those terrible winters to find a new life, you know. And they all settled in North Dakota and Minnesota. And they're all up today, Jesus, it's cold here too. You know? That's all you need to know to understand Norwegians. But they have a very strict church. And I was raised in this very strict church, which... It was a strict church. I didn't know it was strict. It's the only church I knew about. We were the majority. And I learned to sing little songs in Norwegian and learned to... I was confirmed and so on. And they really only seemed to have two rules as far as I could see. You don't sin and you stay away from Catholics. Seems reasonable if you want to go to heaven. Anyway. As I grew older, there seemed to be something different about me. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it seems that I need more fun than other Lutherans do, for some reason. And I got sinning. Then I got monking with Catholics. Eventually, I wound up sinning with Catholics. which is a lot easier than I thought it would be. When I was about 12 years old, still a protected child. My parents got divorced. I was shocked because I'd never seen a divorce. I'd never even heard of a divorce, hardly that I could think of. And my parents got divorced. And I should have known something. I wouldn't have any way of knowing it, of course. But I was a straight-A student. I'd been shoved ahead in school. I was doing fine. And after that, I instinctively did the worst thing a kid can do, I guess. Because I had no training in it. I immediately began playing my mother against my father to avoid any kind of discipline or structure. And I outsmarted him again and again. When my mother gave me hell, I'd run to my father. My father gave me hell, I'd run to my mother. If they both gave me hell, I'd go to my grandma. And I outsmarted him for a long time. By the time I was 15, I was flunking out of high school. I was a mess. I just was doing no good at all. And I didn't know what to do, and I thought I was just so slick. I was a dumb little pimply-faced dummy, but I thought I was slick. And the war started, so one day I told my mother I wanted to go to Superior, Wisconsin, visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me bus fare. And I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea how far it was. I looked at the map on the school library. Not far, you know. And was saved. I got a ride. And I was standing outside. A guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis. And he said, I'm going to hitchhike to San Francisco. No, you're too kidding. No, I can do it. I stood outside Minneapolis. The car stopped. He said, where are you going, kid? San Francisco. He says, good. So am I. Hop in. It turned out he was in the Navy going back to his ship. He just needed someone to help keep him awake, I guess, or something. But we'd stop every night, and he would get me. They weren't motels. They would be trailer courts. He'd get me a little bed in a trailer court, and he bought my meals and listened to my BS. You know, I thought about that many times. What a remarkable man he was. I didn't know it was anything unusual. I just thought that's the way hitchhiking was. You know, you tell people where you want to go, and they take you there. Yeah. In fact, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I'll tell you, I look back now, and I think of all the cases of child abuse I've heard about, and child sexual molestation and so on. And I was on ships with guys, and I was away from home, 15 years old and dumb, and nobody ever made a move on me. It makes you feel unattractive somehow. We got to San Francisco, and I tried to tell my mom, I'm going to the Marine Corps. She can't get the Marine Corps. She said, they're crying for merchants. See, you might be able to do that. They're crying for them. Tell them you're 16. He told me I had to go up to the Post Guard office, and I went up there, and I had my little bag, and he had me fill out an application. He said, you're only 16, kid. Well, after I have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they issued me Seaman's papers right there. Sent me to the National Maritime Union down Montgomery Street. Didn't know what the hell that was all about. Somebody led me on. That was a big union. They had me sign a waiver saying they could take my union dues out of my check. A guy gave me a ride to the Embarcadero. That afternoon, I was on my way to the South Pacific. It was kind of fun for a while. Remember, we went by Treasure Island. I said, that's where the World's Fair was last year. That's Alcatraz. Golden Gate Bridge. But the damn ship just kept going. The earth was slowly fading out of sight. I think I had the intuitive feeling that I had made the first in an endless series of career errors. But they stuck me in a sleeping room. They called it a cabin, I guess, in a forecastle. But three of the worst type of guys that a young, dumb Norwegian Lutheran kid can be with. These kind of people are called men. They were not pleased with me. I discovered why later. I was the fourth man of their deck watch, and they looked at me and realized I wasn't going to do anything, so they just were just screwed. But I could see there's a little tension in the room, so I told them some jokes that I used to go over pretty good in study hall, and get in your damn bunk. I lay in my bunk, and the ship was moving. I couldn't believe it. And these guys start talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco, and I was just shocked. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd never heard anything like that, ever. Just, I could see they were sinners of the first water, just terrible. And I realized they all had black hair. Of course, Catholics. I felt terrible. I really did. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people, if you can imagine. But the ship went along, and I got a role on the ship. I filled a role. There's one on every ship. The ship fool. You know, I never had to do much work, so I didn't know anything. But they, after a while, I got to know my way around, and I got to be the, hey, kid, get on the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. One day, some guy said, hey, kid, you want to drink a whiskey? You think you're man enough? And they'd all been drinking whiskey. And I was shocked. I drew the line there, because I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. They don't do those sort of things. And I was just shocked. I remember my pimples just stood up. And I just wanted to scream. I was about to scream at them. How dare you stick that whiskey in my face? You send me in these dumb errands. I know I'm dumb, but I'm not that dumb. Get that damn whiskey out of my face. I was just about to tell him that, and he said, you think you're man enough? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. I was a little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink of whiskey, and I drank it, and it burned my throat and my stomach, and I threw up and all over this guy. And and what I remember most about that, I still have a vague memory of it, is the ridicule and the embarrassment of that. I don't know anything that's worse when you're feeling terribly insecure than public humiliation. We talked about that earlier, didn't we? That public humiliation just makes you want to... Oh, God, it's just so terrible. You can't do anything. If I had a gun, I'd have shot those guys. It just felt bad. I thought later, there's nothing I could do. I couldn't hit them. Couldn't do anything. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. It would have thrown me overboard. But Hey, big boy, lean over.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Take that. Get me under the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific Ocean, when nobody was around, I'd stick in that guy's sea bag at least once a day and take a drink of that stuff and throw it up and wipe it up because I wanted so desperately to be accepted. Somehow I equated that with manhood. And I couldn't hold it down. Made me sick. And I remember we were just coming into Pearl Harbor. They're still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was down there the day before my 16th birthday. I remember that so clearly. And I took a drink of that crap. That was the first drink I ever took that stayed down. And then I couldn't breathe. Jesus. And a wild. Then all of a sudden something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I realized why people drink alcohol. I didn't, you know, when you're teens, you don't put big, not insights, you just, I've always envied these guys who seem to have insights. I heard a guy a few years ago, he said, when I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience, and there would be many flowers and fruits to be savored in the coming years. Until I left that garden to come to this wonderful program. I never knew that. All I ever knew is, if you can breathe and you don't throw up, you feel a lot better, that's all. I learned how to smoke on that ship. I didn't know anybody smoked, and I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. One day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5-3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. Till I realized I was going bald. Look around here. You can see the smokers. Yeah. I learned how to lust effectively on that ship. I learned to curse a little bit. And I got another ship later. When I was 17, I went in the Navy. And the war at the Naval Hospital up in Northern California, in Pleasanton, being sewed together, and they passed around a bunch of tests. I've always been good on tests because I like to read. And I did very well in this test then, what it was for, and they came back to, oh, Clancy, we're so proud you got such a high score in the hospital. The Armed Forces Institute is giving you this high school equivalency. I thought, geez, big deal. But I went back to Wisconsin after I got out in the spring of 1946, and that really did change my life, although I wouldn't have known at the time. But I look back now, if I hadn't taken that test or done well on it, I'd have had to go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They'd want me to start my junior year of high school again. And I never would have done that. I was much too slick. Instead, I went to college after the war, first class of veterans, 1946. And that really was a boom time. Some of you old people remember that. Most of you young people don't. But it was we had a 50th anniversary 2 years ago of the beginning class of 1946. You think, why would you have a reunion of a beginning class? Because it was such an exotic class, because they're... First and last time, there were millions of people all got out of the service at once and all had the GI Bill to go to college if they wanted to and get paid for it. And a lot of them did it just to decide what to do. And they had to rent buildings, and every college and university was just jam full of people. And you'd go to freshman English class, there'd be some old ex-Marine Corps sergeant sitting there next to some little 17-year-old girl just out of high school. Were you in the war?
Yeah, do you put out?
Well, I fit in. I went to college there. And I later, near the end of my college days, I met this lovely girl, and she had coal black hair and flashing black eyes. I thought, God, I've never known anybody like that. And she won my heart, and then after she did, she told me she was a Catholic. I tried to break free. But we got married. My grandmother had a 2-year depression over that, you know. Well, out in the world, I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. And I'm still the best job. I've enjoyed that more than any job I ever had. But then my wife started this significant pattern that cursed our early years. She began doing things that good Catholic girls do that never tell Lutheran boys about. That is this. If you're married to a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family. Whether you plan on one or not. And I began my second career as a national distributor of small Catholics. Just I used to plead with her. I'd say, can't we use birth control? She said, no. She had something called coitus interruptus. That was a winner, I'll tell you. And But I look back, that was kind of funny, because if she would have said yes, I don't know what the hell I'd have done. Because it's hard for you young folks to realize this, but in those days, I never heard the word condom. Never heard of it. Real bad guys would occasionally say things like, I got a rubber. And I don't know if you ever wanted to use one. Even the bad guys wouldn't go in and buy them. You'd have to hire some derelict or something. And even he would be ashamed. He'd go in and say, hey, give me some cigarettes. And some condoms. Now it's all different. At least in the drugstore by my house, these little punks come in and say, hey, give me some condoms. And some cigarettes. We started having children, trying to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations. And all these years I drank. I didn't think anything about it. I smoked and drank. And I look back now and I realize what an integral part of drinking was in my life. I never paid any attention when I was doing it. Because it seemed to me I had certain problems other people didn't seem to have. And I used to blame it on my parents' divorce and running away too soon and things like that. But I always had a gnawing feeling there's something in me missing. And I don't know what it is. But when I get too close to people, they can spot it. They don't seem to like me much anymore. So you have to keep people at kind of a distance. I never could have an effective one-to-one relationship. After I was sober a while, I began realizing I never had that. I began wondering why. I listened to people's inventories, could see myself in them. But I can look back now and realize why I couldn't have them. Because when you don't have much self-worth or self-approval, you have to get it from outside you. You have to get it from people. And so all I ask in a one-to-one relationship, although I'm not aware of it, but what I wound up doing, all I ask of them is that they treat me special all the time. And not even being aware of it. But I discovered, if you treat me special, why don't you call her home? If you treat me special, I feel average. If you treat me average, I feel rejected. And no one's going to treat you special all the time, so eventually they accept you and treat you regular. Then I realized I never liked him anyway. And on to somebody else. And I never felt like I was quite enough somehow. And I had a lot of fear, not only fear of normal things, but fear of exposure. Fear that people would see that I wasn't anything, that my front I was putting up wasn't right, and I wasn't as slick as I pretended to be. And I always had a terrible, my feelings hurt a lot, which happens when you're feeling inadequate. And I, you know, even when I was sober, almost afraid to ask my wife to dance, just in case she'd say, oh, not now, I'm busy. But I discovered when I drink, so many of these things go away. It's such a great thing. Drinking always made me feel the way I wanted to feel. It takes a person like me and who doesn't feel like I'm enough. And when I have a few drinks, I feel like I'm more than enough. Great feeling. Makes you feel like me that lives with a lot of fear. You learn to disguise it when you're a man. I'm fine. Don't worry about me. Inside, a little voice is saying, I wonder if they really like me. Shut up in there. But when I have a few drinks, sometimes I become fearless. I fight cops. Come on, son of a bitch. I jump off balconies to swimming pools. Don't have a swimming pool, I'll jump on your lawn. Shit, I'm doing too much. Takes a person like me is almost afraid to ask anyone to dance. My own wife, when I have a few drinks, it all changes. The best example of it, I must have used it, said it 1,000 times around the world, but I don't know a better way to say it. You might be late at night in a bar somewhere after work and having a few drinks, thinking how they're screwing you around down at work and brown nosers are getting ahead. Men of integrity are being held back. And as you have a few drinks, you suddenly notice a miracle taking place in front of your eyes. Some old beast gradually becomes beautiful. I might sidle over such an old queen at closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension? Would you like to join me in the old Chevy? If she would say, no. God, if I were sober, I'd just cut my wrist right there. But I've had a few drinks. I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Don't come begging tomorrow, bitch. There's something. And sometimes I drink too much. Then I act bizarre, people say. Been that way for a long time. In fact, I was sent, when I was still in college, I was sent to my first AA meeting. I didn't know what AA was. They didn't know what AA was. They said, some friends were upset. Why don't you go to AA? I guess it helps you cut down your drinking. I said, okay. So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949, which is a long time ago. And most of, many of you newer folks weren't even born. We love you. When I went to this meeting, I'm sure I had the same feeling young people have today. A bunch of old fools sitting around, Javier mentioned, gray haired old guys in their late 30s and 40s. And I don't know what they said, but it seemed to me they were saying things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I just never felt so goddamn wonderful. Anyway, if you like, say, why don't you tell your face? I went to Abe, but I realized why I was like these people at all. I was 22 years old, which was not terribly young in AA now, but then we were talking to dinner, and nobody heard anybody within 15 or 20 years of it, 10 or 15 years of it at least, or 20 years almost. And here I was, just like I was back in that ship again, almost. That's why, I know there's some young guys. The guys that met me at the airport, kind of young guys, but even younger guys. I'm going to tell you something. I guess people don't stop to tell you anymore. But in my home group in Los Angeles, the Pacific group, we have a lot of young people. And if you're like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something. You are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And I'm going to tell you something else. If you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. With my emotions and my feelings for the next few years, I started going to psychoanalysis. I went to AA off and on because the heat was on. They wanted me to go to AA, and I had some victories. I'd go to different cities and I'd do good, and then pretty soon my emotion got a whack. I didn't like this town anymore. This wasn't it, and the people were drags, and I could drink too much and blow it one or another. I'd go to a new town. I was a good writer, so I could always get another job, up and down and up and down, and did wonderfully. Just had new kids, just. And one time I went down and didn't come back up. And I couldn't believe it. Because I'm too slick for this to happen. When, in a relatively short period of time, I guess I'd been pushing the envelope pretty hard, but they repossessed my car. I went off in a drunk to celebrate a discharge from work. And my wife took the children and left. She had never done that. I'd left home several times, but she never left. She went somewhere and didn't know where. She had taken the furniture and sold it. All by my pile of clothes there. And I knew I had to get out of that state because she could put me back in the nut house for that. And I was really in deep trouble, and I found a way to get out of there. I don't know if they still do it anymore, but they used to have driveaways. You look in the paper, and they want you to drive a car somewhere. So I got a car for Los Angeles. That's the furthest you're going. I got as far as to El Paso. I looked up some old friends in El Paso, and I got in trouble down in Juarez and got out of there fast. And I spent a lot of time in Juarez. For me to get in trouble in Juarez, I'd be in bad shape. Yo soy el maestro de los locos in Juarez. And I wound up in Tucson, or Phoenix, and got drunk and got in beef with some guy in the street corner there, and he threw me in jail. He was a cop, turned out. In the middle of the night, I was so sick, and I was so hot there. But the way it is here today, only seemed to be worse, and I was sick. And I went over and threw up in the toilet, and turned out to be a guy's bed, actually. And he wasn't in it, so it wasn't. But I lay down there, went to sleep by it, and he came back and found me and threw vomit, and he got cross with me. He said, damn you drunken son of a bitch. And he kicked my front teeth out. And that was one of the few mornings I was really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis for several years, because I was almost instantly able to recognize his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And I got out of that jail the next morning. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anybody. Went to the PA club. Said, you can always hustle AA sometime if you're lucky. And I went over to the AA club and told some old lady there I needed some money for a stay at a 12-step house. I'd go to meetings, and she gave me some money, and I bought a bus ticket to Los Angeles. And I got to Hollywood. There's a guy out there working in the top announcer of one of the radio stations that I'd hired in a different city. Gave him a start, and I went up and hustled him for some dough. And the second time I went back, he said, don't come back here anymore. You're a drunken bum. I just hurt my feelings. I was out on the beach and didn't know where I was, and a guy dropped me off at an AA club somewhere one night drunk, and I went there and gave him old Russian, told him how stupid AA was, and left. And one morning I found myself in a situation that a person of my intelligence and ability and background cannot be in. Two big guys were throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a damn bum. 3 years ago I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Almaraz for the Borden Company, we're running that very week in Life and Time and Searching Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. Yeah. When you have no front teeth, there's a certain credibility gap. Do you know who I am? I stood outside of that damn mission, and it was getting a little cold. It was a cold, gray morning. There was a little drizzle falling. I thought, I remember standing out there thinking, Jesus, what's going on? This can't be me. I remember thinking briefly, this must be a dream. In a minute, now my wife's going to come wake me up and say, boy, you kicked off all the blankets last night. You really had a dream last night. But it wasn't. And I just stood there, and I had a terrible feeling. I'm sure some of you have had the feeling. It's worse than physical feeling. It's a mental feeling. I could not think of a friendly direction. I couldn't think of anybody who gave a damn whether I lived or died. I'm sure there were, but I didn't. There's no place to go back to or to go to. I thought, this can't be happening to me. If some old guy would have come over to me that morning and said, hey, Slim, you know you're dying. You're down to about 125 pounds. You've lost everything. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. And once upon a time they called you a boy genius. Now you can't get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothing. You had a lot of clothes in Dallas. Got lost somewhere. All you got left is what you got out, and they're torn and dirty and wet. You've lost your home, lost two homes. You're an only child, and your mother's not allowed to accept phone calls from you anymore because your stepfather's so tired of watching you manipulate her to get her wire some more money than break her heart one more time. He would rather have her think you were dead than the way you are. Now, you've been going to AA for a lot of years, sitting in the back and smirking and realizing your case was different. For God's sakes, why don't you just go back to AA and admit you're an alcoholic and do something with your life? If some guy had come over to me that morning and said that, and if I were in a mood to be honest, then anybody that's been desperate knows that honesty is not your top priority when you're in the jam. The top priority is, how do I get out of this? What do I do to get out of this? But if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to tell him, pal, it isn't the way it looks. I know there's something wrong with me, but I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were, because if I were an alcoholic, it would have been so much simpler. I don't know exactly what's wrong with me, but I've known it since I was a little boy, and I've spent my life trying to disguise it one way or another. I've gone to see a psychiatrist, and I don't know what it is. But I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I would not have been able to do that, because I would not have had the objectivity to stand back and examine myself and evaluate myself. So I probably would have done what people like me do when they get cornered and they're afraid. And you take refuge behind bluster. And you say things like, get out of my face! Screw you! Leave me alone! So I wouldn't have known the right answer. I know the right answer now. I've known it for a long time. I learned about myself, and I've seen it in countless people who've come into AA after me. And there's nothing mysterious or mystic, but I've been going to AA off and on for many years in different cities, wherever I worked, whenever the heat was on. And I heard all kinds of people talk, and just very nothing mystical. I knew what an alcoholic was, and I wasn't that. I didn't have much integrity left, but I didn't want to sell out. At least I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, I wish I were, but I'm not. So that begs the question, well, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody in this room knows an alcoholic. Everybody in that street up there knows an alcoholic is. Poor hunchback lady. While you're out there, ring the bells anyway. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. But anyway, that begs the question, what's an alcoholic? Alcoholics are people who seem to drink too much, they can't handle it after a while, and pretty soon they get in trouble, and their lives get screwed up, and their emotions get painful, they get driven to someplace like AA, and AA sobers them up, and they clean up their act, and they live better, more comfortable after that. And we all would agree to that. I've been all the meetings I ever went to, different specifics, different stories, but always the same thrust. When I drank, my life was really painful. When I got sober at AA, and now I'm feeling better. That's the one. Like many times did. I got in trouble like an alcoholic, been hospitalized and jailed and lost everything. But the one thing I could not with my little shred of integrity overcome was this. The way I'm different from an alcoholic is this. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And the longer I try to be good, the longer I do it for my kids or for my job or try it for any reason, it gets so bad eventually. It's almost as though someone's just pushing together a big spring inside of me. I don't know how to explain it. All I know how I feel, and I got to get rid of it. I'll go crazy. And I've read books. I've gone to psychiatrists. I've done taken medications. But I discovered a long time ago, nothing gets rid of it like just a few drinks. And that gets rid of it. So eventually it gets bad enough I have to drink. And I can't explain to people. I'm not really a drinker, you see. I'm a feeler somehow. And I true story. I don't drink to drink. I drink so I can stand it. And then sometimes I drink too much again. Then well-meaning people say, you have a drinking problem. You ought to go to AA. And you have to say, gee, good idea. But inside of your voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. Doesn't anybody understand? My case is different. I don't know why, but there's something wrong with me. But nobody came over to me and talked on that street corner that morning. I was so sick and desperate. And I happen to remember I'd been to this damn AA club. And I didn't know where it was, but I know it was at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that was. And I said to him, where's Wilshire and Fairfax? Well, Wilshire doesn't come through. You have to walk up to Hill Street, cut over to Wilshire, and then go west until you find it. Okay. So I did that. Just get out of the rain. I walked, and I walked, and walked, and walked, and walked. I counted later, a couple years later, in my car, and it was 72 long blocks. That's a long walk when you're sick and desperate and you're cold. And a woman one time in New York said, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so desperate? And, of course, the answer is quite simple. That's the only time you can. That's the only time you can. You couldn't do it any other time. And I got to this damn club, and as soon as I saw it, that's a place I've made that fool of myself in. And I went in there, and not only was it an AA club, but the worst kind of AA club, full of AA fanatics. Jesus. I don't know anything more tedious to an intelligent slipper than to be found by a they're coming back. I was on the meeting. Come on. But it was raining, so I stayed around. That night they had a meeting, and I had about 4 pounds of cake. Some smart ass said, you want an apple, pal? No, I don't want an apple, pal. Some guy talked about how wonderful he felt and made me want to puke, and that just, everybody went home and there was no place to stay. It was still raining. I said to the guy in the closet, because AA, if you give them a sad story, you sometimes can get a little juice even though they don't understand much. And you know, I'm a newcomer and I have no place to stay and it's raining. What should I do? He said, you're in luck. I said, yeah. He said, yes. A guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc out in the parking lot last summer. And it's still there in the tall grass. It's dry and warm. You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? That's a good deal, huh? Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. I slept that abandoned car that night. Next morning, I came in the club. It was Sunday morning. I had a spiritual meeting and talked about God. I wanted to just puke. And I ate about 4 pounds of cake. And that night, there was another meeting. I hung around and waited for it to stop raining. This went on for several days. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what you get for marrying a Catholic. And I have no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Because of all the times I ever got sober, that's the least time I ever planned to stay sober. I had no reason to stay sober, didn't want to stay sober. I suppose anybody who ever slipped as long as I did, and who now has been sober as long as I have, the other couple months will be 40 years since I walked off Skid Row. No applause. You can start a love offering. Help us stay on the air here. I don't know if anybody look back and wouldn't think, what was different this time? What was different? You think, well, maybe I really wanted to stay sober. Not at all. The one time I ever really wanted to stay sober, I had the best reason in the world. I was in jail overnight one night for getting in a beef again somewhere, and then I came down to the jail cell the next morning and say, your little son died while you were out drunk last night. And we couldn't find you. And it just about made me crazy. I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and I put my hand in his casket and I said, John Immersland, this will never happen again in our family. And I was working in Texas, went down to work in Texas, and my family came down and the heat was on. You may wonder if you could stop drinking if you got a good enough reason. And the answer is absolutely yes, you certainly can. For a while. And then it starts to unravel, just little by little. And all of a sudden, one day, there's that spring. And the job I used to like, I didn't like anymore. And the people I didn't used to like, I didn't like. And my kids will bring it for, they're noisy. And Mary, take your sister and go to your room. I'm sorry, Daddy's not feeling well. I didn't know what to do. But I can't drink. And it got so bad, one day my wife took the kids to church. And I just pulled the car in the garage, hooked up the hose and the exhaust pipe, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And the guy next door happened to be looking out the window, and so I didn't come out and amble over to see what was wrong. Heard the motor running and found me dead in the car and pulled me out and breathed my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and examined me and put me in a severe high security ward and committed me to the Texas State Insane Asylum as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. Nothing in my commitment papers said alcohol. This is just psychosis. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. Really not a big goal in my life, you know. I've often thought I'd like to go back to Texas someday and find that psychiatrist that made that diagnosis, a dual personality diagnosis. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good, you know. You quack! Describing me as a dual personality, you idiot! If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. Jesus. My problem has always been this group that gathers in my head. Let's get out of here. Don't think we can. What do you think? I'm not sure. I used to hear people at AA say things like, I'm not sure the program's enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol. Alcohol reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice.
Why don't you quit your job and punch that bastard in the face?
Hard to explain that to your family later, I'll tell you. No, I didn't want to stop drinking. One time I was talking in Canada about chronic last year, and some woman, they had a question and answer meeting. And you probably have guessed this about me now, but when they'd ask me a question, if I couldn't think of the answer, I'd talk till I could. Yeah, a weave of tapestry of some sort. This woman in the back said, I've got a question, can I say? I don't want one of your long answers. She said, just a sentence or two. What was different this time? A sentence or two, what was different? Could not imagine. I was taking a shower later, and that night I thought about it again. I thought of the answer. It isn't a very satisfactory one. If you're new, it probably sounds stupid. But as far as I can tell, the major difference this time from all the other times is this time is the first time I felt so out of it that I was willing to do things I didn't agree with and I thought were stupid. Actions that I thought were beneath me intellectually and emotionally. Things that were stupid. Stupid things. You know, it's almost like being back in that ship again, you know. And I didn't want to stay sober. I was hanging around the damn club, and I was there 2 or 3 weeks, and I was sober, and I got into a terrible, you know, just doing things I didn't mean to. I remember standing at night, 7 o'clock, thinking, God, they all, I don't want to go to any one of those damn meetings. I was sick, and not eating much, and I'd get what I can, and I gotta get some teeth so I can't get out of here, get some clothes, do something. Jesus, I gotta get out of here. I'm just gonna make me crazy. I can't get out of this club tonight. Come on, Patsy, we'll go to the meeting. Hop in the car. Hop in the car. I didn't mean to. Come on, Patsy, we'll help Fred move his furniture. Oh, shit. I kept doing dumb things, and eventually they get to this stage. I'm sure they do it in Fresno, or everywhere else.
Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor.
So I saw this actor who used to come in the club, and he was an AA member. He wasn't a star, but he was always a character actor, and he always played loving uncles and loving cousins and brothers and kindly, good, generous guy. I said, Bob, will you be my sponsor? He said, sure, little kid, just got to do what I say. Oh, sure. I thought about that later. That guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you that. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. And he used to just grind at me. I used to think later, why would I take that? I never took that in my life. One of the marks of being kind of a weak guy is you got to pretend you're strong. You can't let anybody push you around ever. Now that this guy pushed me around, how dare you? I remember thinking, you know, I like people who like me. I have no respect for them because they're stupid. And I like them. I hate people who can see through me. But I respect them. Begrudgingly, I respect them. But I hate them. And somehow this guy could see through me. At the same time, he seemed to like me anyway. Sometimes. I remember I did things just for get his pat on my back that I wouldn't do for nothing. And little by little, he got me to do dumb things and stupid things and silly things. And I somehow stayed sober. I remember going to him after a couple of months of sobriety. You know, Bob, I'm not eating very much. I eat a little bit. People feed me and so on. But I mean, I'm just not doing very well, Bob. What do I do?
I said, get a job.
I said, look how terrible I look, Bob.
Get a terrible job.
And I did that. I started this hideous. And he, I remember when I was 6 months sober, I'd been staying with a guy in his basement, and his wife had made him put me out because I was putting out cigarettes to the carpet. While the ashtray was on the other side of the room, and it wasn't my fault. And I got a job as a dishwasher, and I got fired at that after 2 days. And I just had to kill myself. I just had to go to the ocean and just throw myself in, just walk in like a star is born, just walk in. And I'd all be sorry someday. And I walked and walked and walked and couldn't find the goddamn ocean. I stopped at a grocery store. I said, gas station, where's the ocean? I said, well, you're just in Western Inner Beverly Hills. You have to walk past the Veterans Hospital and about 4 more miles after that. Oh, I don't think so. I don't mind dying. I'm not going to walk myself to death. So I called up my sponsor. I thought, you know, I used to be a good writer once upon a time. And I used to be a good writer. Maybe I can tell him a story that's so sad, even his rotten heart will be softened and he'll come and offer me some money. Hello, Bob. This is Clancy. Why aren't you working at that job? Let me explain. You know, I know that you know I've lost my family. I'll never see them again. And I understand that. And I can't seem to do very well about life. And you know that. I'm back living at the car. You know that. But there's something you don't know. You know, around this club, when you're not around, a lot of times people just treat me badly. I mean, I sit down at a table with someone, and they'll get up and move to a different table. I go to meetings, they call on me to talk once, and then they never call on me again, even though I try to be honest and tell them what's wrong with them. I mean, people around me are all getting better. I just have no place to turn, but nobody likes me. I'm just out of it. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. And I burst into tears. It's the saddest thing I ever heard. I said, what am I going to do, Bob? What am I going to do? And he explained. He said, why'd you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you? And I just told him a week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why want to take it with an out-of-work actor, for God's sakes? What good that is? I said, my judgment, Bob, that's the last thing in the world. I mean, I'm so full of guilt and remorse and pain.
I just want to go over that stuff again. In my judgment, I need something much more.
And he explained that. He said,
in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. I don't care about your judgment. You're a loser.
Now, can you imagine talking to a newcomer that way? I got so upset. I came out of that phone booth. I'm glad I turned left. If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in the ocean in 4 steps. Yeah. Get back to the club. I said, someone! Get him in prison! I'm going to write my angry boy! And I wrote, God, I wrote things I never told anybody. Never just, oh, terrible things. People say, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? Well, when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you're not. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, stop and wash off that chair. And I got all done this terrible thing. I felt a little bit better. At least I proved it didn't work. And a week later, I was terribly depressed again. He came picking up the club at night and took me for a ride to along the ocean to Oxnard. He gave me a flashlight. He said, read it. Well, I don't feel much like reading it now, Bob. He said, I don't care what you feel. Just read it. So I read this terrible. Oh, God, I'm just so embarrassed. I thought you were going to make me get out of this car. But he just yawns. That's pretty good, kid. I couldn't understand it. And but I've taken that trip over 200 times since then on the driver's side with some other boob over there with a flashlight. Let me explain this part before I read it. I'll tell you something amazing. I'm telling you amazing. To the best of my knowledge, all honest inventories are exactly the same. The specifics vary all over the lot, but they always incorporate certain structures. Lack of self-worth, guilt, feelings of inadequacy, and occasionally lashing out at the world for hurting you. And they all got in one variety or another. A few years ago, I heard an inventory from the daughter of probably the most famous man in the 20th century, and another week later from a guy who was born under a bridge in El Paso and never knew who his father was. And their inventories were exactly the same. Entirely different specifics. He just out of the Washington State Penitentiary and she lived in a penthouse. But same thing, same emotion, same feeling. And it's that way all over the world. That's why you find AA the same all over the world. I've been sober a long time, so I've had an opportunity to do some things that most of you haven't had a chance to do yet. But in the last few years, I've been asked to speak in places, exotic places like Cape Town and Johannesburg and Berlin and Ireland. I'll be back there next month, as a matter of fact, in England and Norway and last week in New Zealand and Australia and Canada. You think you find all kinds of exotic AA in all these places, but you don't. You find the same thing, different accents, that's about all. People talking about the same things and they all know their case is different. And true story, that's what kills people like us. No one denies the fact AA works, but my case is different, you see, and so I don't have to do those things. But every group seems to boil down to this. There's a group of people who've come to AA, taken the actions, much to their dismay sometimes, but eventually turned around and found a way to stay sober. And there's a group of people who hang around the fringe, and they're the sharpies and the losers and the people and the scoffers. And there's the new people. And both of these groups fight for their soul. And the winners are saying, come on, do these things. And these losers are saying, oh, you don't have to do all that crap. You don't have to do those things. And the newcomers, it's easy to understand why they want to go this way, but hopefully we go this way. But that way all over the world. And A is the same emotion, same feeling, same thing, just to interpret it all. And I little by little did these things, and eventually I got a little bit better. I stayed sober anyway. I finally got a place to live inside, and finally held it. I finally, when I was 2 years sober, I got a job as a little writer in the medical corporation. And I went to work every day. My sponsor taught me some great lessons on that job, and I held that job. He said, oh, here's some great spiritual messages. Now, if you think, what's spirituality? Well, prayer, meditation. Yeah, that's nice. Let me tell you some spiritual messages about that world out there. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not going to be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. children, employees, waiters and waitresses. On days when you know you're having a bad day, watch that damn mouth, because all of us have a tendency just to, if I'm feeling bad, goddammit, you're going to feel bad. And you ruin, it creates some problems. Well, I'll tell you, that sometimes haunts you for the rest of your life. But these are a bunch of other things. I never learned them very well, but I learned long enough to do that job. And when I was 5 years sober, I'd become advertising director of that corporation. I had front teeth then. In case any of you are new and have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. This is not like that guy that lost his leg. Now, 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, babe?" I was 10 years sober, I was down, being public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, my wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas. Leaped out of the post office box with hideous cries, fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody got me a timekeeping device after that, that it helped. And it's called a rhythm system. And eventually they were all grown up, three of them are in AA now, 9 years each, and the rest of them aren't. And I live in a house out by the ocean. I've held the job I got now for 25 years. Doing quite well. Thinking about maybe a little easing off to some kind of mild retirement, not much. Is there anyone here in their first week of sobriety at all? You are, Chad. Let me tell you something. It's going to make you feel better. I've got it all together, and you haven't. I know you're happy for me. Well, everything I've told you is true. But all this is an introduction. I want to talk to the people in their first 30 days, the people who are having difficulty. Or as they used to say in the Lutheran church, who are weak and heavy laden. That's a tough situation. I want to just quickly say, this is a long introduction to this talk. The most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said, my name is Clancy Emmerslund and I'm an alcoholic. You might think, when did he become an alcoholic? Was he an alcoholic when he drank? Was he an alcoholic when he got sober? When did he become an alcoholic? Well, the one thing that all stood my way was this. My problem really isn't alcohol. It is when I'm drinking, I'm drunk. But nobody seems to understand when I'm not drunk, it's worse. And just imagine doing these dumb things to please a sponsor and to be around a bunch of people. I survived long enough to discover that the book Alcoholics Anonymous says specifically, if you're an alcoholic, your problem is not alcohol. I couldn't believe it, for Christ's sake. So if you're kind of new, you might think, what do you mean the problem is alcohol? Everybody knows your problem is alcohol. I could disprove that in 5 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Hospitals. They turn out people who are physically sober with varying amounts of information what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee if they be like me, or I presume like you, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later they will always eventually drink again. Or sedate heavily. Well, if the problem is alcohol, what is it? Is it something mysterious they're keeping it from us? No. Nope. Everyone in this room, new or old, knows what's wrong with them. But they may not know they know it. The problem here is something that sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people die because they confuse it. The problem here is something called alcoholism. You say, well, it's the same thing. Is that alcohol or alcoholism? Not at all. Significantly different. I'll guarantee if you be like me, the day will come when your sanity and life will depend on remembering the difference. Well, what's the difference? Well, I could talk about that for an hour. I did once. That was in South Africa. I was just trying to punish him. But I can put it in one sentence tonight, and here's the sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, identical in appearance mostly, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. That no matter what your reasons are for stopping, eventually the pain of sobriety will be less so great that you must welcome the drink that will relieve it. And even that doesn't make an alcoholic. One other thing must be present. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8 or 9% of people who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And the curse of this is nobody ever knows it's an unnatural reaction because they have nothing to compare it against. It's like saying, do you have an unnatural taste to strawberries? I don't know. They just taste like strawberries. Who knows what's unnatural? Same with alcohol. So the question is, if you're new, what is this unnatural reaction? You hear old-timers say, I stayed drunk for 20 years around the clock. Nobody ever stayed drunk for 2 weeks around the clock. Body won't let you.
Well, yeah, crazy or depressed and all these things.
Some people do that. I see people today die from alcoholism who've never acted crazy once. So what is this remarkable reaction that nobody ever understands? It's something so simple, I wouldn't have guessed it in 1,000 years on my own if I hadn't been taught it. Alcohol must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right. That's all. You think, well, that isn't very much. It's more than anybody else gets, I'll tell you. That's why they don't drink. It's not because they're spiritually or superior. But most people, when they drink, 90-some percent of people when they drink, they get warm, they get fuzzy, get a little dizzy, don't feel good, and they drink. And I never knew that. All I knew is when people drink alcohol, it all of a sudden makes things look different and better. And you want some more, and it feels good, and you're something. And that's why they will never understand why I drink, and I could never understand why they don't. Really? Stop after work with a guy that used to be my friend. Might as well have another drink. No, I have to get home now. Betty's got dinner waiting. Oh, has she? Why don't you wear her dress tonight, too, you wussy girl? But alcohol makes things all right. The only one problem with that, if it does that, little by little, you get to use conflicts in your life. Most people have to live with the conflicts and solve them. I can get rid of them for now. I'll get through them. I'll take care of the problems tomorrow, little by little. And one day, drinking gets to be a problem. Now you got to stop that. So you go back to being sober, and it's worse than it was before because you haven't taken care of it. So eventually you got to drink. And you can't keep drinking, so you've got to get sober. And you can't stay sober, so you've got to drink. And that's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sober people than anywhere in the history of the world, it's estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. And I'm sure they all say one version or another of the same thing. But you don't understand. You see, my case is different. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief and got a little out of hand. And they never know. They've just defined the disease of alcoholism. And the reason that's important to know if you're kind of new tonight, you people who are new, is coming and sitting in an AA meeting is going to make it better. You'll get sober. That'll be nice for a while. But the natural state of sober alcoholics is growing anxiety and depression and desperation. And it might take you a little bit longer in an AA meeting. They'll come. The purpose of AA is not to get you sober. Being sober is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why so many people want to argue around the country. Can I understand it? Well, I'm off alcohol. I take all these other things, but I'm off alcohol. The purpose of AA is not to get you off alcohol. It's to learn to live in reality, goddammit. I told him at dinner that I must be the only one in the room who spent an hour talking to Bill Wilson. And I did that in 1963 when I was 5 years sober. And I should let it go at that. We didn't talk about what I just said, but I can imply we did. We talked about me, of course. But the entrance to AA is sobriety. Then after you're sober a while, it starts to get uncomfortable and bad. And that's when you try AA. And that's when you surrender, start taking actions you don't agree with. And you ask someone whom you respect, whether you much like them or not, you respect them. Somebody who has what you want, as they say. And you allow them to superimpose actions over your perceptions because you cannot trust your own head, which is all over the lot when you're emotional like that. There's an old saying, it really is true, never go into your head alone. It's a dangerous place. That's why they say don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Not because they're bad things. They're perception distorters. And alcohol, I use that to overcome it. You know, when I'm hungry, people get stupid. I don't know why. They just... When I'm angry, God wants me to kill them. For their own good. When I'm lonely, I know they're all at a party somewhere. They didn't tell me, did they? No. When I'm tired, they really attack. I find myself many mornings on the freeway driving to work in the morning. And I conceal being so tired because I know not to keep up. But they know it. You just see some old lady up around La Cienega saying, see the boy in the gray caddy? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off. But the one thing AA has done for me, I have learned, I no longer have to chase people past my exit. If I have them caught them by 4th Street, I say, good flying, Red Baron, but we'll meet again. A few years ago, I came off the Santa Monica Freeway to the Hollywood Freeway, I mean, the downtown freeway, and some little girl looked kind of like you, a young blonde girl. She cut me off and almost put me in an overpass. And I thought, Jesus, she almost killed me. And you, when you chase people, you can't do anything to them anyway. All you can do is catch up and give them a ray. But she almost killed me. I chased her past my exit. I chased her a third of the way to Pasadena for her own good. And I got next to her, I gave her a quadruple ray. And she looked at me, and I suddenly realized she was about 17 years old, long blonde hair. I thought, what kind of a guy have I turned into? I got a granddaughter who looks like that, little Katie Doherty looks like that. And what do I do if some son of a bitch would do that to her? So I smiled. And she went... I've discovered here that taking the actions of AA, you know, it's hard to realize that because most people like me who think they know something, when I have emotional problems, I want to go to someone who's trained with emotional problems, a doctor. And he says, you come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. And you see these well-meaning AAs, they're nice people, but they can't even get that right. You come to us and we'll change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change. No, I don't think so. But somehow you got to survive to realize, long enough to realize, these well-meaning amateurs have 10,000 rooms full of sober alcoholics all over the world, and the doctors do not have one. There's a moral there somewhere. You may come to, you know, have a belief in God. I couldn't. I had to believe in my sponsor. Because if God existed, I was damned forever. But he got me to take actions that eventually allowed me to believe in AA. I did that for quite a while. One day I found myself, because some kindly man suggested I try, I went home and prayed. I was afraid. I thought maybe God would get me. But nothing happened, and I prayed to that God earnestly every day for 38 years now. And I'm not to, if you're new, I'm not telling you to believe in God. I'm saying this, I would rather have you believe in your sponsor that you do believe in than pretend to believe in a God you don't believe in. Because you can fool them at 8 o'clock at night at the meetings, but you can't fool that dark at 2 in the morning. And you better have something there that you can believe in. But little by little, it all gets down to one thing. The last thing I want to say, we're talking about this at dinner tonight too. When I was about 15 years sober, I had this terrible occupational problem picking bad jobs. And I left a job when I was 15 years sober as a marketing director in Beverly Hills. And for the last 25 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you want to give up your great career to run that damn mission? And I couldn't think of an answer. I thought, well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it must be spiritual. But that's where I was today. I went to work this morning, down Skid Row. And you might think, isn't that nice, that wonderful old man going to help the others? It's not quite that way. Monday morning when I get up and go to work again, my car still wants to get off in Beverly Hills and get to that office where pretty girls in tight sweaters would say, here's your coffee, Mr. Emerson. Anything else?
Not now, Monica. Hey.
I have never said that before, and I will never say it again. But it did sound cute, didn't it? But anyway, to get off there instead of go down to Skid Row and see who smashed her head into the sidewalk last night in a fit of died or got sick and desperate, or these poor old sick illegal aliens hiding out on Skid Row and they get afraid and they stab people. It's just a river. It's not a treatment center, nothing like it. We're blood trying to keep people alive. We feed 2,200 meals a day to starving men and women and children, and we try to clean them up, and once in a while I can snatch somebody out of there, and I got a staff of 120 people, and every one of them is off the street, and that's what makes it. And sometimes we can make a difference, and sometimes we can't. But after I leave Skid Row, I go home, and I think, God damn it, the 121 of us, we changed the world a little bit today. Not much, a little bit. And that gives you a better feeling than going down all the elevators in Skid Row and on Beverly Hills and popping your fingers, thinking how slick you are. I want to say one last thing to Chad and all the other new people here. Don't misunderstand me. Even if you go to meetings, get a sponsor, get active, get involved, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. So I'm here to tell you the truth. Here's what I've learned in the last 40 years around here. I've learned that I'm an alcoholic. So I can able to say, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary to drink any alcohol or take any mind sedating or tranquilizing medications since 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.